I now have the pleasure to call upon Tom Moll, Associate Professor in the Department of English and William Dawson Scholar at McGill University, to introduce our keynote speaker, Alberto Monguel, who will be delivering a talk with an enticing title, The Uses of Curiosity. Professor Moll will handle the question period following this talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. Good afternoon, and welcome to this keynote lecture, which concludes a day-long symposium called Meetings with Books, Raymond Klibanski, Special Collections, and the Library in the 21st Century. It's my pleasure and privilege to introduce our speaker this afternoon, and there could be no better speaker for this event than Alberto Monguel, who, like Raymond Klibanski, reads far and wide among the books of the past, while always keeping his eyes on the concerns of the present. He writes, "I believe that we are, at the core, reading animals, and that the art of reading, in its broadest sense, defines our species. We read our own lives and those of others. We read the societies we live in and those that lie beyond our borders. We read pictures and buildings. We read that which lies between the covers of a book." Until the white smoke poured out of the Vatican last week, Alberto Monguel was probably Argentina's most famous expat. In a long and peripatetic career, he has lived in Argentina, Israel, France, England, Italy, Tahiti, and Canada. Did I miss any?
No.
But wherever he is, he lives among books and earns his living from them. His travels among books, like his travels around the world, have been wide-ranging, continually renewed, and driven by a generous curiosity. His literary journey began auspiciously when, as a 16-year-old working in a bookshop in Buenos Aires, one of the customers, now almost blind, asked Monguel if he would read aloud to him. The customer was Jorge Luis Borges, and Monguel read to him several times a week from 1964 to 1968, an experience he later recorded in his book with Borges. Like Borges, Monguel is a reader's reader, a walking library, a man of oceanic knowledge. He wears his learning lightly and moves nimbly across fields of discourse where others, who wear their learning like a garment lined with lead, get laboriously bogged down. He is the author of 5 works of fiction and 20 non-fiction books, and the editor of a simply stunning number of anthologies, the best known of which is Black Water, the book of fantastic literature. He has received many prizes, was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship and honorary doctorates from the universities of Liège in Belgium and Anglia Ruskin in Cambridge, UK. He is an officier de l'ordre des arts et des lettres in France. He last visited McGill in 2007 to deliver one of the Massey lectures, later published as a brilliant book, The City of Words. Broad and various as Monguel's work is, there are some threads running through it that make him a valuable guide to the world of books and reading and an ideal lecturer for today's event. He carries certain books with him mentally, and they reappear, sometimes in unexpected ways, throughout his intellectual journey. Don Quixote, Alice in Wonderland, and the stories and fables of Borges, among others, many others. But he also pays close attention to the material conditions in which texts circulate. As he writes in an essay on anthologies, the same text may appear very different when it appears in an anthology than it would if encountered elsewhere. Or, as he describes it in The Library at Night, libraries have a critical role to play in our civilization as deep repositories of our memory and experience that inflect the meanings of the books that they store, organize, and circulate. Alberto Monguel is therefore attentive both to the text as a linguistic construct, a thing of words, which can work its way into a reader's consciousness and lodge itself there, and to the book as a material form, whose production, circulation, and reception is embedded in social, historical, and commercial contexts and contingencies. In Mangel's reading and writing, texts call out to one another, and books whisper secretly to each other on the library's shelves. Stories shuffle off their original contexts as they get reshuffled in the pages of an anthology. Books reveal unexpected patterns and connotations as they are assembled into collections. And all this making, unmaking, and remaking of meanings is also the way that we make and remake ourselves in the stories we tell ourselves and others about who we are and where we belong. Boundless curiosity drives Alberto Mangel's reading, as well as a boundless desire to share what he reads. But curiosity has an ambiguous reputation as something both desirable and risky, valuable for scientists, proverbially fatal for cats. This ambivalence about curiosity is the topic of his talk this afternoon, which is called The Uses of Curiosity. Please join me in welcoming Alberto Mangel.
Thank you very much. I'm honored and not a little awed to be here. Oscar Wilde, once giving a talk in Oxford, said that he felt like a poor lion in a cage full of Daniels. I know what he meant. On November 26, 2011, an exploring device the size of a small car was launched from Cape Canaveral at 10:02 in the morning. After traveling over 350 million miles, it reached the planet Mars on August 6, 2012, and landed on the desolate plain of Aeolis Palus. The name of the exploratory craft was Curiosity, the desire for knowledge that Dante called Ardore and that drove Ulysses to undertake his one last fatal journey. Throughout our convoluted histories, stories have had a way of reappearing under different forms and guises. We can never be certain of when a story was told for the first time, only that it will not be the last. Before the first chronicle of travel, there must have been an odyssey of which we now know nothing, and before the first account of war, an Iliad must have been sung by a poet who is for us even fainter than Homer. Since imagination is the means by which our species survives in the world, and since we were all born, for better or for worse, with Ulysses' ardore to know the world, and since stories are, since the dawn of time, our way of using imagination to feed this ardore, no story can be truly original or unique. All stories have a quality of déjà lu about them. The art of stories, which seems to have no end, in fact has no beginning. And that is why, according to Talmudic commentators, the first word of the book of Genesis, Bereshit in Hebrew, begins not with a letter Aleph, but with the letter Bet, to remind us of the infinite that lies behind the first spoken word of creation. Because there is no first story, stories grant us a sort of retrospective immortality. We make up stories in order to give a shape to our questions. We read or listen to stories in order to understand what it is that we want to know. On either side of the page, we are driven by the same questioning impulse, asking who did what and why and how so that we can in turn ask ourselves what it is that we do and how and why we do it, and what will happen when something is done. In this sense, all stories are mirrors of what we believe we don't yet know. In spite of being aware of this, we are more concerned with beginnings than with ends. Endings we take for granted. They tend to comfort us. They allow us the pretense of conclusion, which is why we require memento mori, to remind us of the need to be conscious of coming to an end. But beginnings trouble us daily. We want to know where and how things start. We seek wisdom in etymologies. We like being present at the birth, perhaps because we feel that what came first justifies or explains what comes afterwards. And we dream up stories to give us a starting point towards which we can look back and feel a little more secure, however difficult the process. Dreaming up endings, instead, has always seemed easier. The good ended happily, and the bad unhappily, Miss Prism tells us in The Importance of Being Earnest. That is what fiction means. The fiction of beginnings is more complex. In spite of the wonderful infinitude offered us at the start of the Bible, it is other explicit stories that provide the religions of the book with a beginning. Two narratives of creation follow each other on the first pages of Genesis. The first tells that God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he him. The second, how God, in order to provide Adam with a helpmeet, made him fall into a deep slumber, took out one of his ribs, and from this made he a woman. Implicit in the divine creative act is the subservient function of women. Countless biblical commentators explain that this is the reason why a woman, as an inferior being, must obey a man. At the same time, a number of others try to reinterpret this patriarchal reading in a more egalitarian light. In the first century of the Christian era, the Jewish scholar Philo of Alexandria proposed for the earliest biblical narrative a Platonic interpretation, suggesting that the first human created by God was a hermaphrodite, male and female created he him, and for the second narrative, a misogynistic reading in which the male half is conceived as superior to the female. Philo identified the male half, Adam, with a spirit, nous, and the female one, Eve, with a physical senses, aesthesis. Severed from Adam, as if she represented sensations severed from reason, Eve is denied in the act of creation Adam's primordial innocence, and thus becomes instrumental of the fall of humankind. Two centuries later, St. Augustine, in his literal interpretation of Genesis, reinstated Eve's primordial innocence by declaring that in the first Genesis narrative, Adam and Eve, still unnamed, were created with all their spiritual and physical characteristics in potentia, that is to say, present in a virtual state that would flower into material existence as described in the second narrative. That is what you call having your original cake and eating it too. Scholars more or less agree that Genesis was written in about 6th century before the Christian era. Some 3 centuries later in Greece, Hesiod reported a different version of the story of female guilt. Zeus, Hesiod tells us, furious at Prometheus for having robbed the gods of the Olympian fire and given it to humankind, decided to avenge himself by sending down to earth a beautiful virgin, crafted by Hephaestus, dressed by Athena, adorned with gold necklaces by Pytho and with garlands by the Horae, while Hermes filled her heart with lies and misleading promises. Finally, Zeus bestowed upon her the gift of speech and the name Pandora, and presented her as a gift to Epimetheus, the son of one of the Oceanides. Forgetting Prometheus's warning never to accept gifts from Olympian Zeus, that's good advice for everyone, Epimetheus fell in love with Pandora and took her into his household. Until that time, humankind had lived unburdened by woes and care and deadly disease, all of which were secretly kept in a covered jar. Pandora, curious to know what the jar contained, took its lid off and unleashed into the world all manner of pain and suffering, and I love this detail, and the illnesses that haunt us at day and night in silence because Zeus had deprived them of the use of their tongue. Horrified by what had happened, Pandora tried to put the lid back on, but not before our sufferings had all escaped, leaving nothing but hope at the bottom of the jar. Curiosity and punishment for curiosity. The typological reading of the stories of Eve and Pandora date from at least the 2nd century in the writings of Tertullian and Saint Irenaeus. In both cases, the Godhead bestows upon humankind the gift of wanting to know more and then the punishment for trying. I think that here is one of those paradoxical instances in our mythologies that is worth disentangling in order better to understand its importance. Leaving aside, at least for a moment, their misogynistic resolutions, both stories concern the question of the limits of ambition. A certain curiosity seems permissible. Too much curiosity gets punished. But why? The tension between curiosity that leads us to discovery and curiosity that leads us to perdition threads its way through all our endeavors. The temptation of the horizon is always present, and even if, as the ancients believed, after the world's end, the traveler would fall into the abyss, we do not cease from exploration, as Ulysses tells Dante in the Commedia. In the 26th canto of the Inferno, Dante meets the entwined souls of Ulysses and Diomed, burning in the fire that eternally consumes evil counselors. The character of Ulysses begins life on our shelves, but probably much older, as Homer's ingenious and persecuted King Odysseus, and then through a series of complex reincarnations, he becomes a cruel commander, a faithful husband, a lying con man, a humanist hero, a successful adventurer, a magician, a ruffian, a trickster, a man in search of his own identity, and Joyce's pathetic everyman. Now, Dante is so attracted to the horned flame that his body leans involuntarily towards it, and he asks Virgil's permission to address it. Virgil appeals to the flame as a poet and begs it to tell its story. Then the larger tongue of the flame speaks. Ulysses' story, which Dante imagined and is now part of the myth, concerns a man not satisfied with the extraordinary life he has led. He wants more. Unlike Faust, who despairs at how little his books have taught him and feels that he has at last reached the limits of his library, Ulysses longs for that which lies beyond the end of the known world. After being freed from Circe's island and from Circe's lust, Ulysses senses that there is in him something stronger than his love for his abandoned son, his aged father, his faithful wife back in Ithaca, the ardore to gain further experience of the world and of human vices and virtues. Then, in the course of 52 luminous lines, Ulysses will try to explain the reasons that drove him to undertake his last journey. The desire to go beyond the signpost that Hercules had set up to warn humans against sailing further, the will not to deny himself the experience of the unpeopled world beyond the sun, and finally, the longing to pursue virtue and wisdom, or as Tennyson put it in his version, to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. Because Dante the craftsman has to submit to the adamantine structures of the other world as a framework for his poem, Ulysses' place in hell is that of the evil counselors, guilty of spiritual theft because he has used his intellectual gifts to deceive others. But this is not the sin that interests Dante the poet. Instead, what he wants Ulysses to tell him is how he met his end, and therefore, what was it that drove him after all the obstacles Neptune has set on his return journey to sail not home to his bed and hearth, but onwards into the unknown, because in Dante's version there is no return to Ithaca. Ulysses, whose soul now burns in this eighth circle of hell, meets his end as a punishment not for the fault for which his soul now suffers, but for going beyond what God has deemed permissible curiosity. Like Adam and Eve in the garden, Ulysses is offered the whole of the knowable world to explore, only past the horizon he must not venture. But precisely because the horizon is the world's visible and material limit, just as the tree of knowledge of good and evil is the limit of whatever can be perceived and therefore known, the forbidden horizon and the forbidden fruit implicitly admit that something else can be achieved beyond the commonplace. This is what Robert Louis Stevenson confronted daily in the Presbyterian Edinburgh of his youth, where the gray facades displayed one after another the Ten Commandments in a perseverance of thou shall nots that Stevenson was later to call the law of negatives. That is to say, the pleasurable temptations offered as in a dark mirror even to those who have not yet conceived them. To Ulysses' fateful curiosity, Dante counterpoises that of Jason, captain of the Argonauts, who set off with his companions to collect the golden fleece and who returned home victorious with his booty. As Dante the pilgrim is approaching the end of his journey in paradise, when he finally sees the ineffable form of the entire universe, he compares his astonished vision to that of the god Neptune seeing the shadow of Jason's ship gliding by, the first human craft to sail the god's desolate waters. The comparison grants Dante the blessing of a quest that has been allowed and is therefore meritorious, as opposed to the damned quest of the unfortunate Ulysses in search of the forbidden unknown. Now, bear with me for a while I take you along the road of this comparison. I promise you we'll get somewhere in the end. In terms of Dante's theology, that is to say, in terms of the theology of Aquinas and Bonaventure, curiosity can be of two kinds. The curiosity associated with the vanitas of Babel that leads us to believe ourselves capable of supernatural feats such as building a tower to reach the heavens, and the curiosity of humiltà, of thirsting to know as much as we can of the divine truth, so that, as St. Bernard prays for Dante in the Commedia's last canto, si che il sommo piacer gli si dispieghi, so that joy supreme may be unfolded to him. In a part, the section of the Convivio, quoting Pythagoras, Dante defined this wholesome curiosity with great precision. He says, lover of knowledge, a term not of arrogance, but of humility. Ulysses' quest is physical, material, ambitious. Dante's is spiritual, metaphysical, humble. In both, curiosity is the essential attribute of their human nature, of simply being human. But while in Ulysses, this being means being in space, to be in space, in Dante, it means to be in time. And this is a distinction, of course, that the Italian language allows much more clearly than the English language, where stare for being in a certain place and essere for existing. Hamlet, of course, solves the problem by implying both. The dichotomy latent in the phenomenon of curiosity simultaneously hampers and drives forward every one of our quests. The brave words Tennyson puts in Ulysses' mouth, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield, is partly wishful thinking. Striving and seeking, as we know all too well, do not always lead to finding, and yielding in certain cases may not be offered as a choice. What persists, however, even when we surrender to insurmountable obstacles, and even when we fail, is the impulse to seek. Of all the possible modes offered us by our language, the natural one is the interrogative. As both Eve and Pandora knew, curiosity is the art of asking questions. What is the knowledge of good and evil? What is my role in the garden? What lies inside the sealed jar? What am I allowed to know? And what am I not allowed to know? And why? And by what? To understand what it is that we are asking, we disguise our questions as narratives. Narratives that put questions into words and then open these questions to further questions. Literature is, in this sense, an ongoing dialogue that resembles the Talmudic form of argument known as pilpul, a dialectical method for reaching knowledge through even every time keener questions. though sometimes it is used merely as hair-splitting debating exercise. Essentially, it's something else. So essential is the art of questioning that in the 18th century, Rabbi Nachum of Bratslav was able to say that a man who has no questions about God is not a believer in God at all. In a very concrete sense, writing stories, collecting stories, setting up a library of stories, assembling a special collection of stories, are activities that give roots to the nomadic impulse of curiosity. Ulysses' quest leads him into a maelstrom that swirls his ship around three times and then closes the sea over the crew. Dante's leads him to the final point of coherence, the gathering of the scattered leaves of the universe now bound by love in a single volume. I love the fact that the final metaphor for the universe, for everything that we can know, is a book. However, this vision prevents Dante from translating that volume into comprehensible words. He sees it, but he can't read it. Well, assembling books, we mirror Dante's gesture, but because no single human book can fully translate the universe, our quests resemble Ulysses' quest, where the intention counts more than the result. Every one of our achievements is a paradox in that it opens up new doubts and tempts us with new quests, condemning us forever to a state of inquiring unease. The late Renaissance materialized this paradox in mnemonic and didactic machines, in which the questioners could, these were real machines, sometimes like they were like pop-ups, as you know, in printed books. So in these machines, the questioner's curiosity, following a mechanical system of associations and information retrieval, is rewarded with answers that are open to a number of interpretations. These machines, material incarnations of our belief that the meaning of things lies within our reach, adopted all manner of ingenious forms. They were either intricate versions of our Excel charts, designed like family trees of many branches, or they were constructed as wheels that moved one inside the other to elicit couplings between the concepts written on the margins. Sometimes they were even conceived as wonderful pieces of furniture, such as the wheel of books designed by Agostino Ramelli in 1588, designed to stand next to the reader's desk like a three-dimensional version of Windows. This is a wonderful wheel on which little stands, and on each stand or each lectern there is an open book, and so you sit at your desk and take notes and you turn the wheel to get to whatever book you want on whatever open page. Now, each of these machines works differently. Labyrinthine machines, such as those depicted in Orazio Toscanella's Harmony of All Main Rhetoricians, they were vastly ambitious titles, were designed to help structure rhetorical arguments stemming from any given premise. The procedure is complicated, but let me see if I can give you an idea of how it works. The initial idea is reduced to a single proposition, which is then divided into subject and predicate. So far, so good. Each of these, subject and predicate, can then be boxed in one of a number of categories inscribed on one of four wheels that make up Toscanella's machine. The first wheel is dedicated to subjects, the second to predicates, the third to relationships, the fourth to questions such as why, what, who. Every point of the wheel can become the starting place of a new quest. Now, these machines are too complex for a non-scholar such as myself to describe accurately, and I'm not at all sure that even if I understood the rules better, I would be able to use one effectively. But what is obvious, however, is that these machines were concrete representations of the methods of curiosity. And even when supposedly allowing their users to reach the desired conclusion, they continuously suggested different pathways for new inquiries. I'm sure that if Eve had had one of these machines in the garden, she wouldn't have had to go to for the apple at all. Beyond their use as how-to manuals or cataloging tools, these machines promised to help think. One of their inventors, Ludovico Castelvetro, defined his art as the science of asking why. Now, less than a century after these machines were being built in the Italian peninsula, in the British Isles, a very curious Scotsman, not yet 30 years old, imagined a system that would allow him to set out in writing questions that arose from his brief experience of the world. Decrying that in philosophical disputes, 'tis not reason which carries the prize, but eloquence, he very eloquently proceeded to interrogate the assertions of metaphysicians and theologians and to inquire as to the meaning of curiosity itself. At the end of the second book of his treatise on human nature, the 20-year-old David Hume, bearing in mind the unease we referred to earlier, attempted to distinguish between love of knowledge and natural curiosity. The latter, Hume wrote, derived from quite a different principle. Bright ideas enliven the senses and provoke more or less the same sensation of pleasure as a moderate passion. But doubt causes a variation of thought, transporting us suddenly from one idea to another. Now, this, Hume concluded, must of consequence be the occasion of pain. Not every fact elicits our curiosity, but it is sufficiently important if the idea, Hume says, strikes on us with such force and concerns us so nearly as to give us an uneasiness in its instability and inconstancy. Questions that follow one another, and then questions that leap from thought to unconnected thought, illustrate the different path followed by Dante and his Ulysses. Ulysses' curiosity is in fact the shadow of Dante's and leads to Ulysses' tragic death. Dante's quest ends as all comedies end, that is to say, with a happy and successful climax. But Dante's achievement, as he repeatedly tells us, cannot be told in human language. Much of the otherworldly voyage, many of its terrors and marvels, even Dante's own wavering undertakings, are expressed in the clearest possible verse. But the actual, final vision is ineffable, beyond the scope of human art, partly because he is describing his movement towards the primordial good, because after all, this is an Aristotelian voyage. And Dante says that each thing that moves is in some respect lacking, and does not possess its whole being at one time, so it can never succeed. If by success we mean the full achievement of our endeavors, then failure is an integral part of Ulysses' attempt, as it is an integral part of Dante's all-apprehending poetic attempt, as it is, in fact, an integral part of every artistic and scientific enterprise. Art advances through defeat, and science learns mostly from mistakes. What we don't achieve maps our ambitions as much as what we do achieve, and the Tower of Babel stands unfinished less as a memorial to our shortcomings than a monument to our exultant chutzpah. As Dante certainly knew, no human quest is exclusively one or the other, Ulysses's or Dante's. Every investigation, every inquiry, every exploration is fraught with an undergrowth of questions, moral, ethical, practical, whimsical, through which we advance and from which we cannot disentangle ourselves. Some progress, of course, is made, but always accompanied by swarms of doubts and irresolutions, when not a feeling of guilt and transgression that results in the designation of a scapegoat, Eve or Pandora, the village witch or the heretical thinker, the inquisitive Jew or the nonconformist gay, the alienating outsider, the unorthodox explorer. Imaginative researchers in biology and chemistry, brave scholars in unofficial histories, illuminating critics of art and literature, revolutionary writers and composers and visual artists, lucid scientists in every field, even as they seek a truth comparable to the one Dante sought, face again and again the dangers that awaited Ulysses on his final journey. This is how our thinking evolves, trying to see at each turn not only the possible answer to our questions, in other words, the questions that will be conjured up next in our quest, but also the aleatory, sometimes tragic consequences of treading unexplored landscapes. The question of how to find cures for deadly illnesses elicits the question of how to feed an ever-increasing and aging population. The question of how to develop and protect an egalitarian society elicits the question of how to prevent demagogy and the seduction of fascism. The question of how to create jobs to develop the economy elicits the question of how the creation of these jobs might tempt us to turn a blind eye on human rights and how it might affect the natural world around us. The question of how to develop technologies that allow us to hoard more and more information elicits the question of how to access, refine, and not abuse such information. And as Professor LaRue pointed out this morning, the question of why should we pursue knowledge if that knowledge does not bring good and peace? The question of how to explore the unknown universe elicits the uneasy question of whether our human senses are even capable of apprehending whatever it is we might discover on Earth or in outer space, on Mars. I began by saying that the NASA craft, Curiosity, landed less than a year ago on the Martian plain of Aeolis Paulus. The site, Aeolis Paulus, was named after the king of the winds, Aeolus, in whose realm Ulysses stopped on his own marvelous journey. In the 10th book of the Odyssey, after escaping from the hunger of the Cyclops, Ulysses, who called himself Nobody, which also means everybody, reaches Aeolus's island. Here he was feasted by the king for a full month, and upon leaving, he was given a sack of ox hide, in which Aeolus had bound the winds up tightly with a silver cord, allowing only Zephyr, the west wind, to help Ulysses on his way. The west wind in late medieval iconography, and this is in Klibanski's and his co-author's book on Saturn and melancholy, represents the sanguine man, that is to say, the optimist, the constant searcher, someone like Ulysses himself. After 9 days' travel, the crew began to suspect that the Aeolus's sack contained a treasure which Ulysses intended to keep for himself. So they loosened the cord, and in a dreadful gust, all the imprisoned winds escaped, unleashing a terrible storm that drove the ship back to Aeolus's island. Offended by their carelessness, the king of the winds banished Ulysses and his crew from his realm and sent them off to sea without the smallest breeze. In the story of the beginning of a new chapter of Ulysses' journey, not a woman, but a bunch of curious men are to blame for the disaster. If we care to construct a typology between the curiosity of Ulysses' companions and the curiosity vessel that landed on Mars, we could build up a little cautionary tale about the dangers of discovery. But more interesting, I think, more instructive, more rewarding, is to read the episode in the context of Homer's entire poem and in Dante's illuminating sequel. In that case, the unleashing of the winds is a circumstantial disaster that takes place in mid-adventure, cautionary only in the sense that the outcome of our quests is not entirely dependent on our own actions. Rather than demeaning Ulysses' performance, the episode adds strength to his determination, to his thirst for knowing more, to his ardore. And if in the end, as Homer has it, Ulysses reaches Ithaca and defeats the suitors and tells Penelope his version of the story, or whether, as Dante imagines, he refuses to bring the story to an end and continues his search until he can seek no more, what matters is that Ulysses never gives up his questioning. Dante, who is given in the end an answer too vast to comprehend except as an impoverished memory, envies, in a sense, Ulysses' fatality. And so, for the sake of the poem's logic, he must condemn him. He lends Ulysses words that, spoken from the hovering flames, seem to transcend Ulysses' fate and survive his condemnation. The defining nature of curiosity is made hideously clear in one of the essential texts of the 20th century, in Primo Levi's If This Be a Man. I spoke of Dante's pilgrimage through the other world and of his encounter with Ulysses. Ulysses, like all other souls in Dante's hell, suffers a punishment that he himself has fashioned during his life on earth. To illustrate this law of the other world, Dante imagines for each sinner what is known as the contrapasso, that is to say, a self-inflicted retaliation. In Dante's imagination, we, and not God, are responsible for our actions and for the consequences of our actions. Dante's world is not the world of Homer, where whimsical gods play with our human destinies for the entertainment of private purpose. God, Dante believes, has given each of us certain abilities and possibilities, but also the gift of free will that allows us to make our own choices and to assume the consequences of those choices. And even the quality of the punishment itself is, according to Dante, determined exclusively by our transgression. So, Ulysses is condemned to burn invisibly in the forked flame because his sin, that of counseling others to practice fraud, is a furtive sin, so he's hidden inside the flame. And since he has committed the sin through the tongue, it is in tongues of flame that he is eternally tortured. In Dante's hell, every punishment has a reason. But Auschwitz is a very different kind of hell. Soon after Primo Levi's arrival at Auschwitz, in the midst of a terrible winter, sick with thirst, locked up in a vast unheated shed, he sees an icicle hanging outside the window. So he sticks out a hand and breaks the icicle off, but a guard snatches it from him, throws it away, and pushes Levi back into place. Warum? Asks Levi in his poor German. Why? Here is kein Warum. Here there is no why, the guard replies. Now that is the essence of Auschwitz hell. In Auschwitz, unlike in Dante's realm, there is no why. A contemporary of the Renaissance memory machine inventors, the German poet Angelus Silesius, trying to speak of the beauty of the rose, wrote that die Rose ist ohne warum, the rose is without why. Now this, of course, is a different why. The why of the rose lies merely beyond the descriptive capabilities of language, but not beyond language's epistemological scope. Auschwitz's why is beyond both. To understand this, we must, like Levi and like Dante, remain stubbornly curious. Raymond Klibanski, whom I'm sorry I never got to meet, was very much aware of this vital need for curiosity. Recently, after a lecture I gave in Mainz, a man came up to me and we started talking, and he told me that he had been a student of Klibanski's in Wolfenbüttel, and that he remembered him as a brilliant, vastly knowledgeable scholar of great perspicacity and kindness and wit. Before leaving Wolfenbüttel to continue his studies elsewhere, this man asked Klibanski if he had any advice to give him. Apparently, Klibanski smiled and said only two words, immer fragen. Always ask questions. Thank you. Speaking of questions, are there any?
Must have left you with some curiosity. You need not fear that your curiosity will be punished here. If you would like to ask a question, could I ask you to move to one of the two microphones in the aisles so that we can all hear?
Should I stay here? Thank you. I will have the courage to ask a question. That was wonderful. Thank you so much for that presentation. You referred at one point to Professor Klebanski's work on melancholy. And I think amongst the many definitions or descriptions of melancholy, there is an intellectual curiosity leading to melancholy would be amongst the ones that would have been identified by Professor Klebanski. And I wondered if you could just talk a little bit more about those, whether you see that connection, which I think is probably there to be made. Thank you.
I don't know this is working. Yes. I don't know if I dare comment on melancholy after giving a talk that is named after Raymond Klebanski. Obviously, his book is fundamental. His book and Panofsky's and Saxel's, of course, is fundamental for any understanding of melancholy. You mentioned as melancholy leading to intellectual curiosity. I think it is also discussed in the book the contrary, that is to say, intellectual curiosity leading to melancholy. In fact, I think that is the Aristotelian idea, the link between melancholy and creativity. But really, I don't know enough about it, so perhaps I should leave it at that and recommend the book that, of course, you have already read.
Well, it's a pleasure to hear you today. I'm sure many people were curious to hear you. But I'm curious to know what sparks your curiosity in you. Is it a special gray cell? Is it predetermined? Is it something that comes out of serendipity?
Could you... I didn't hear you very
okay.
well.
I am curious about your curiosity, your own curiosity. Is this a predetermined genetic factor, you know, a little gray cell in your mind? Is it something that is stirred by serendipity, something that you've never noticed before, or something that you've always seen and then, oops, all of a sudden it's something new?
I think I've always been aware that I've been curious. And I think I've always been aware that my curiosity is hardly ever rewarded. I think that one of the most extraordinary revelations of anybody who likes to read stories is that literature is exactly the contrary of dogma, that dogma provides answers, and literature simply gives you more questions, better questions, but no answers. It awakens in you the curiosity of wanting to know, is Don Quixote really crazy? Has Alice dreamt her voyage, or is the rest of her life a dream? Is Madame Bovary guilty of something? And nothing in the stories allows you to give a definitive answer to these questions. Borges, and I seem not to be able to give any of these talks without quoting Borges at least three times. Borges, speaking about an episode in the Commedia, the episode of Ugolino, where Count Ugolino, Dante comes across his soul gnawing on the head, on the skull of Cardinal Ruggiero, who in real life has imprisoned Count Ugolino with his sons in a tower and condemned them to die of hunger. And Dante doesn't tell us exactly if Ugolino ends up eating his children or not, his children who have offered themselves to him. And commentators since the beginning of since the first manuscripts of the Commedia have argued whether Ugolino has or not eaten his children. And Borges has this to say. Borges says, in history, obviously the real Ugolino must have either eaten or not eaten his children. But in Dante's poem, Ugolino eats and does not eat his children. That is the place towards where I like curiosity to lead me.
Thank you.
I feel, perhaps you may agree or disagree, but I feel somehow uneasy with the curiosity of Dante. And the reason for that is because somehow his curiosity is guided and there is an end to it. But in the case of Ulysses, there is no limit and he's on his own. That's a thought.
Except that for Dante, Ulysses does not go home and his curiosity is cut short by someone. Dante doesn't even say God. It's someone. And there is nothing to indicate that Dante's curiosity is satisfied. I have the sneaking feeling that, assuming that Dante had this poetic experience, and there's no reason to believe why he didn't, that he didn't, his curiosity may not have been satisfied, and that is why he writes the poem. I would like to think that. Borges, and this will be the second quote, just before dying, days before dying, had an idea for another story he wanted to write. And this was a story of Dante before dying in Ravenna, ends in Venice, and in Venice imagines a sequel to the Commedia. Now my curiosity wants to know, what could that sequel have possibly been?
Would you say that perhaps ambiguity is the characteristic of not only literature, but all art, as opposed to dogma or propaganda or anything that gives a clear answer as opposed to a kind of unclear answer?
As long as we don't lend ambiguity a negative sense, I'm a little wary of the term ambiguous because it is taken to mean that the writer has not been clear. Shakespeare's Hamlet is certainly ambiguous. Why the hell does he not make up his mind? And yet it's perfectly clear. Except that we cannot express it in the form of an answer. The only way to answer the question of why does Hamlet not act or why does he act the way he acts is to read the whole of Hamlet. And then you come again to that question. But you will know more. So I'm a little hesitant about using the word ambiguity, and I prefer to think of it as richer wider, deeper questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for your very thoughtful talk. I want to put a question. Curiositas, it's a Latin word. And everywhere in Latin literature and then in philosophy, it's always a vice. And then suddenly it turns upside down. Somewhere in the 16th century, it becomes something necessary for research. What occurred? What's your reading of that?
I would like to say that I would place the switch a little earlier, that is to say, already in Dante, there is a distinction between the curiosità peccaminosa and the enlightened curiosity. But this may be a philological development, one of those instances in which a word that has been used in one context then is used to define something that does not yet have a word, like I'm thinking of humilitas, for instance, going from the sense of poor, lower class, shabby, to one of the qualities of the Virgin Mary, for instance. But I don't know enough about the particular evolution of the word, except I can think of some instances in which it is used in a positive way in Petrarch's Secretum Meum, or, so a little earlier perhaps in the 16th century.
If we go more to earth, what Dante found in his search or is his role of curiosity in Beatrice Portinari?
I'm a little bit deaf. So
in Beatrice Portinari, what he was looking for?
What was he looking for?
You describe very well Ulysses, and
yeah.
I'm a little bit interested in Beatrice.
Dante doesn't know what he's looking for in the beginning. That is to say, he has no idea what is happening. He comes out of that dark forest, and he's full of sleep, and thinks that he can take a shortcut up to that shining mount, and then the three beasts appear, and Virgil appears, has been sent to take him the long road and give him a lesson as they go. And he has no idea what he's looking for. I mean, the first thing when Virgil tells him that he has been sent and that he's going to take him through the three realms is that, but who do you think I am? I'm not Aeneas. I'm not St. Paul, who have done this kind of journey. Why me? And even when he gets to the end of Purgatory and Virgil tricks him into crossing the wall of flame by saying, "Oh, I can see the eyes of Beatrice shining there." So he says, "You go ahead." Anyway, and he finally gets there and he thinks, I've done it. I'm on the other side, and now it's this lovely garden, and here comes Beatrice. And the first thing she does is insult him to tatters, just thinking, it's accusing him of all sorts of things and shaming him as if he were a child. He still doesn't know what he's looking for, what the questions are. And constantly throughout the trip. Sometimes he asks a question, and Virgil is very happy, and sort of like a teacher, the student has asked a good question, and Virgil is very happy, and other times he says, what are you doing? I mean, this, haven't you read your Aristotle? I mean, shouldn't you know the answer to this? Why are you asking this? And so on. So my idea is that Dante has no idea what he is looking for until he finds it. And once he finds it, he cannot put it into words. The vision is granted, but as has to happen when you have the vision of everything, it has to go beyond language, which is part of what you see. If what you see is everything, you cannot, one of the parts of what you see cannot define the whole. Let's quote Borges a third time, then we're done. This will be a double quote. Borges has a story called The Writing of the God about an Aztec priest who is imprisoned by the Spaniards in a deep well, and in the bottom of the well there is a wall, and on the other side of the wall is an imprisoned jaguar, and the myth that that is part of the religion of this priest is that the gods have left on earth their writing, and that whoever can recognize that writing, can decipher that writing, will have all the powers in the universe. It's a very old legend in all sorts of different mythologies. And every day they lower food for the prisoner, and when they do, light shines in and he sees for a second the jaguar. And the priest reasons that the gods, when they put the writing for someone to decipher in the world, they could have put it anywhere, so why not at the bottom of this well in his prison? And then he realizes that it might be on the spots of the jaguar. And so every time the light shines for those few seconds, he looks at those spots and deciphers finally the writing of the gods. And then he is absolutely powerful. Everything in the world is at his reach. And he can destroy Cortes and the Spaniards and reinstate the empire, and he doesn't do anything. Because now that he can do everything, there's no point in doing anything. And so he ends his days at the bottom of the well. I think that what the story tries to tell us, I think that what Dante recognized, is that our strife, our curiosity, is what makes us move, what pushes us forward. The point is not getting to an answer. The only possible answer is the grave. And so until we get there, we can continue to ask questions. We must continue to ask questions. Is there a revelation on the way? Borges, this is part of the third quote, there isn't a fourth. In a little text called The Wall and the Books, has what I feel is the most exact, revealing definition of what is art. He takes us through a series of questions about why is it that a poem moves us, music moves us, a beautiful scene moves us. And Borges ends by saying that it is the imminence of a revelation, the imminence of a revelation that does not take place.
That seems like an ideal moment to stop. We know that curiosity has no end, but lectures must have an end. I am going to hand back to Anne-Marie, but before I do, please join me in thanking Alberto Mangel for a rich and rewarding lecture. Thank you very much.
wrap things up after such a wonderful talk, I am pleased to call upon Dean Cook to conclude today's symposium.
Thank you. It was my privilege to begin the day, and I get to have the final word, too. So first thing in order is to thank our keynote speaker, Umberto Mangel, for his truly spectacular lecture. And, by the way, whose books are available outside and whom I understand will sign them for you, too. And I can assure you that Phil Vadnimifagen. My job today was to welcome everyone and to say goodbye. And friends and colleagues, the only thing I can say is that this has been a spectacular and wonderful day in celebration of the book. The enduring value of rare and special collections in the age of information as a generalized statement. More specifically, that world is manifested in our very own McGill Special and Rare Collections, as Richard Verz showed us this morning, and as a particular instance in the life of Raymond Klebanski, who as a lover of books, was a particular reflection of the life of the mind as represented in the book. Truly a wonderful day in honor of the book as a whole. I want to thank all of our moderators and speakers, and a very special thank you to Anne-Marie Holland for keeping us on track all day. She looks a little more tired than she did this morning. To all of those in the dean's office who labored behind the scenes, and not only the dean's office, but many others who helped us put this symposium on today. Very specially to Raymond Klebanski himself, who through his life gave us a reason for the celebration of the book in this symposium. And a most special thank you to Madame Ethel Groffier, whose brainchild this symposium was. And as a very special note, for me and my librarian colleagues, an enormous special thank you to all of you as lovers of books through history have provided all of us with a very privileged life as stewards of humankind's libraries and the books therein. Enjoy further discussion over a glass of wine, please. There's a reception outside. And I hope to see all of you again. I won't say goodbye, I'll say au revoir as you visit us in our rare and special collections here at McGill. Thank you all.